From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, what's going on in hospital wards caring for a crunch of younger COVID-19 patients?
This just isn't something they'd seen in these numbers previously.
Also, Detroit City Council trailblazer Raquel Castaneda Lopez talks about why she's leaving politics to go back to advocacy.
Really, how I approach and believe our democracy should work is that to truly have a reflective, inclusive democracy, you should have some change in leadership.
And we get up close and personal with one of the biggest fish in the Great Lakes, the sturgeon.
They have been around for a long, long, long time. And before humans came around, there really wasn't anything that could take on a sturgeon.
But even these giants can use a little hand-holding when date night rolls around. Today, a fish biologist explains how you can help. Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a look at the messier side of working on Detroit City Council.
As I said in my statement, it was never just about me or one politician. It's about the collective we and our shared movement for social justice and racial equity. And you need people in all seats across the city to be able to truly move those policies forward, not just in District 6.
Later in the show, it's an exit interview with Council Rep Raquel Castaneda Lopez, who says she's not running for re-election. But first, Michigan is seeing a small but hopeful drop in the number of new daily COVID-19 infections reported. There's optimism that hospitalizations may have peaked too, but many places like Sparrow Hospital in Lansing are still overflowing. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells spent time on one of the COVID units at Sparrow recently, where workers say this third surge feels both new and horribly familiar.
So let's go ahead and get started.
So the day at Sparrow starts the same way 5 days a week. The big wigs, the department leaders, get together at 8 a.m. It's called the Incident Command Meeting. And they essentially go through the fires that they have to put out that day, starting with how many people are in our hospital today.
We're at 100% capacity with 50 additional overflow spaces in use. And there's 12 patients in the emergency department waiting.
This is Jean Bishop. She is the director of nursing operations here. And she's got this like little Mickey Mouse pin holding up her name tag clipped to her blazer. She's hearing reports from staff at the community hospitals who are calling in via Zoom. They're part of this Sparrow system, and they have so many COVID patients who need more care that they can provide that they're sending all of these folks to this main hospital.
I know Eaton transferred 8 out of their ER last night. We transferred, Clinton transferred 5 out of the ER last night.
Another new issue that they're having with this third surge that they haven't seen before is they've got a lot more of these pregnant moms coming in with COVID and also really little kids who need to be admitted for COVID. This just isn't something they'd seen in these numbers previously. Jean Bishop goes over and huddles with Kathleen Marble, who runs pediatric nursing operations. And I ask them, you know, how young are we talking here when we're talking about kids that need to be admitted with COVID?
A couple months.
Couple months?
Yeah.
And then I just want to know, well, how sick are we talking about here?
Well, the ones that are in PEDS ICU are needing, you know, respiratory support. They're on a ventilator, just like the adults are.
For Bishop and Marble, this is when the real work of the day starts. They remind me of kind of an old married couple in that, like, they've clearly worked together very closely for years. They kind of bicker as they try and figure out literally where are they going to put everybody.
9 is open, 10 is open.
Those are doubled.
I know, I don't know. You need to tell me. I don't know.
So after incident command meetings end, everybody disperses. They go to their own units. We go up to the 9th floor, which is one of 6 floors that have been turned into these overflow COVID units. And before we can go into a patient's room, you know, obviously there's a ton of PPE. You've got literally an oxygen machine strapped to your back. It's pretty heavy. That goes in with a tube up to this hood. You look like an astronaut or like one of those deep sea divers. And it's such a weird way to go in to see a patient who is so vulnerable and is wearing just a gown. You look like you are talking to them like they are a toxic specimen. And I'm feeling super awkward about it. The woman that I'm here to talk to is Annette Seifert. She is 63. She's been here about a week, and she's getting better, but emotionally she's really struggling.
It's so hard. It's so lonely.
It's so lonely here, she says. When we're talking, she has these long pauses between sentences because she's got this high-flow nasal cannula that's putting oxygen into her body, and she has to stop every so often and just try and breathe out of it.
I've always been the caregiver.
I've always been the caregiver, she says. She says her daughter has pretty intense medical issues. She's been caring for her. And then she has to just pause altogether, and she just takes a huge breath. And we just are completely silent in the room as we just listen to her trying to breathe. Her face is pretty stoic, but she's got tears streaming down her face as she looks at me. And I ask her, you know, what made you... This is clearly so difficult for her to even just talk. I ask her, you know, what made you want to talk to a reporter right now, of all things?
It's lonely in here. That's the biggest reason.
I just wanted to see some faces.
I got three faces in here now.
We thank Annette for taking this time and tell her that we hope she's just going to keep getting better. Just down the hall from Annette is another patient. Her name is Quinita Glynn. She's only 42 years old, and she was very, very sick when she got here. She's been here almost 2 weeks, and she's making a really good recovery.
I feel 100% better. Came in here about 13 days ago. My body just felt beat.
The thing about Glynn is she has asthma, so she has taken the pandemic incredibly seriously. She knew that this would be life-threatening for her. Basically hasn't left the house in the last year unless she had to. She's got four kids. They've been doing virtual school. Only last month did she let the sixth grader go back to school in person. She doesn't know if that's how she got it. It's a possibility. She didn't know that she had COVID. She thought she just had a bad sinus infection there for a while. And then one afternoon, her sister comes over and says, I'm taking you to the emergency room, because she was just so disoriented. She gets there. She starts crashing. She needs so much oxygen that for a while they had to put in a special feeding tube.
You know, I've been calling COVID devil. You know, I call it the devil. I'm not going to let this devil defeat me. You know, it's bigger than this. I'm going to get out of here. Now, like I said, I got a testimony. This is part of my testimony. This is part of my story.
One thing that Glynn thinks about is how close she was to getting vaccinated. Like, just last month, she was talking with her pulmonologist about how, you know, April 5th was on her calendar. She was going to get the vaccine.
I was so close. I fought the fight. I'm determined to, you know, waiting for April 5th, and here come COVID. You know what I'm saying? So I tried to push it in quarantine, and I just almost made it.
The good news is it looks like Glynn is going to be able to be discharged here pretty soon and able to go home to her kids. She is going to need like a home oxygen machine, but things look good. Out in the hall, I run into Dr. Kenneth Thompson. He's a family medicine doctor, and he's doing some rounds here. He's clearly like the guy who does a lot of dad jokes and is the ham. Like, he's over in the side being like, this box of gloves only has left-handed gloves. We must have gotten a discount. And the nurses are sort of rolling their eyes. And I ask him, you know, how's everybody holding up?
Well, we're all ready to have a party day someday. It's tiring. Yeah. You know, it's, you know, the big adrenaline rush in the beginning. You had the command center. Oh, we're here. We're going to help everybody. And then you get, you know, it's, oh, you're only on mile number 6. It's 20 to go. You got to be kidding. I sprinted the first 6. I didn't know I had 20 to go.
This is the thing about a third surge. Several of the nurses and caregivers that I talked to say they just feel exhausted, obviously. They don't feel like that appreciation is there anymore. And they've lost people, too. You know, Dr. Thompson talks about one of the doctors here that they lost just a couple months ago, Dr. Rick Lopez, and how hard that has been for the staff to just keep going.
Picked it up in his office.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. His wife's worked here. She's still here. She's been here 33 years.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw her the other day. She's still working because she says, if I don't work, I just sit home and cry. So she's still working here at Sparrow.
I don't know really what to say to him about that. Well, his resident pops her head out of one of the patient's rooms and starts waving him over. And he takes a deep breath and turns around and heads out. And he's like, gotta go be a hero.
All right, you guys. Have fun.
Take care.
Wear a mask. Save a life.
That story from Michigan Radio's Kate Wells. Last night, the Academy Awards looked a whole lot different than anything we're used to. The show was staged in a small auditorium that looked more like an intimate dinner theater production, with tables of actors and movie makers considerably spaced out at Union Station. Questlove DJed the affair, and there was no host leading the night. Those two things both mark an improvement, if you ask me. And the Best Picture category was awarded before Best Actress and Best Actor. There was another moment that you don't see every year at the Oscars. A shout out to Michigan. Steven Yeun, nominated for his role in the film Minari, also presented for the award given for Best Visual Effects. And here's what he had to say before announcing the winner.
When I was 7, living in Taylor, Michigan, my mother took me to watch Terminator 2 at the theaters. I'm pretty sure she didn't know what the movie was about. And to her and my surprise, we got to see some stuff. We got to see T-1000 get his head blown off and then form back together. And Arnold cut his arm skin to reveal a robot hand. And I just remember glancing at my mom a few times trying to see if this was okay for me to watch. And my mom playing it cool as if she meant to bring me to this movie. But maybe that's just my memory. Maybe she reveled in the fact that she got to see a badass mom duke it out with future robots with her son in 1991.
Steven did not win last night in the Best Actor category. That went to Sir Anthony Hopkins, but we are so proud of this Michigander nonetheless. Way to go, Steven. Well, it's that time of year. Love is in the air, but sometimes true love needs help. Especially if you happen to be a sturgeon.
We are asking people to volunteer as a sturgeon guard to be visible in low key to detour any type of poaching that would happen in the river.
In a moment, scientists ask for your help making this spawning season go just a bit smoother. We'll be right back. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. If you've ever seen a lake sturgeon, you know that there's something really mystifying and beautiful about this ancient fish. It's kind of like a swimming ginkgo tree, unique and primitive and special. They're also a threatened species and have a large community of human supporters and enthusiasts who are committed to helping the sturgeon bolster its numbers. To that end, the Michigan Department of Natural Resources is putting out a call for volunteers to help shepherd sturgeon along the Black River to their spawning groups. Michigan has 7 or 8 Black Rivers. If you're thinking to yourself, well, which Black River are we talking about? The sturgeon make their annual sojourn on the Black River in Sheboygan County, at the tip of the Lower Peninsula, and they're in need of protectors for their journey now through June. With us to explain the need for human help is Dave Borgeson, fisheries supervisor with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources. Dave, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we're also speaking with Brenda Archambault, the head of the organization Sturgeons for Tomorrow, which is taking a role in this. Hi, Brenda. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Brenda, can you explain what it's like to have these massive fish swim by you when you've encountered them?
It is quite a sight to behold in that these fish are adult spawning fish, which is why they're in the river. But they're gentle giants. Yet when they're in the river in the springtime, they're vulnerable to would-be poachers. And, you know, watching spring come to life and then seeing these fish in all their glory in the river when, you know, the areas are relatively shallow and they're vulnerable. So it's quite remarkable.
Dave, for those who've never had the pleasure, could you describe the look and the personality and I guess the habits of the lake sturgeon?
April was interesting. when you talked about just the mystique surrounding them. And it's so interesting when people actually see them up close and encounter them. Gentle giants, how Brenna described them, is perfect because they have been around for a long, long, long time. And as adults, before humans came around, there really wasn't anything that could really take on a sturgeon. So in the river, they're basically felt, you know, invulnerable. And they still have that trait where they come in. You can canoe and kayak right up next to them, and they almost don't take any notice because, you know, evolutionarily, there wasn't really anything that would harvest them until we came along. So that's why this guarding program is so vitally important.
Right. I mean, these sturgeon, they're really, I mean, not to get too hung up on their size, but they're really big, 4 or 5 feet long sometimes, correct?
6-7 feet in yeah. Michigan.
Right. Brenda, tell us about the spawning season. What path do the fish take?
Well, typically each spring, a small percentage of the adult population will migrate upstream to spawn, trying to reach back where they were spawned. So they imprint on where they were born. Now, the interesting caveat to that is males are, you know, 12 to 20 years old before they will first reproduce, and females are 17 to 30 years old. So it takes them a long, long time for them to be able to reproduce. But when they are migrating upstream to spawn, it is quite a sight to see these big fish in the river when typically you won't see a sturgeon unless they're in a shallow river. And to be able to be on guard to protect them while they're spawning has really become a eco-volunteerism opportunity for people throughout the basin to have an opportunity to get out, you know, break the cabin fever, if you will, you know, watch spring come to life, see what's going on in the river. But yet at the same time, researchers are in the river collecting biological data. So you're able to view that as well.
Well, so let's explain in a little more detail, what is the role that you're asking humans to play in helping make sure that the spawning season goes off smoothly?
We are asking people to volunteer as a sturgeon guard, to be visible in low key, to deter any type of poaching that would happen in the river. So we recruit volunteers and set them up on site, give them shifts, give them the orientation, issue them a sturgeon guard hat so that it identifies that you're a part of the sturgeon guard. And that is what we do. We work in collaboration with the Michigan DNR, the law enforcement, and the tribes, and some other covert operations just to secure the area to protect would-be poachers.
Did you just say covert operations?
I did.
That's so cloak and dagger. I love it.
Well, we've got to do what we've got to do. We say what we mean and we mean what we say.
It sounds like what we're talking about here, Dave, is asking people to chaperone sturgeon date night. What exactly are the threats to the sturgeon as they're making their journey?
Well, when we first surveyed this population, it was done in the 1970s, and the estimate was, you know, over 1,000 fish. And we resurveyed in, like, I think 1997, and found it, you know, the adults had declined around 500. There was a legal season, and we could only attribute maybe half of the mortality to that legal harvest season. So, and they have such great survival once they're, you know, a foot long or so. We knew something else was getting them. And with a lot of incidental reports of poaching and that sort of thing, we knew that poaching in the river was a significant factor in the reduction of the population. So we reduced the harvest season, but also we needed to get a handle on the poaching. And Sturgeon for Tomorrow stepped up big time. They said, how can we help? You know, these are our sturgeon. we want to protect them. So what it is, it's multifaceted. Number one, it's just having eyes out there to notice any sort of activity that is maybe poaching, or and then be able to report that activity to enforcement personnel. And just having people on the river guarding the sturgeon, I think that alone is a deterrent, but it's also a great way to have people invested in the fish and see the fish and value the fish. And when these people realize these fish are valuable for a lot of different reasons, over time, I think the attitude changes. So maybe we can affect even the motivation for poaching. And Brenda and the Surgeon for Tomorrow folks do coordinate some great outreach and education programs, at least not when it's not the pandemic. And that changes a few things. But it's been a great a program for a lot of years. And I know it has protected sturgeon.
Brenda, can you tell us a little bit about those programs?
We created a Sturgeon in the Classroom program that is a statewide program. And with the streamside rearing facilities stocking fish to help repopulate strained populations, we retain some fall fingerling sturgeon. Let's say they're 7 inches long. And instead of stocking those into the lakes, we retain those and then we deploy those into classrooms so that they can learn more about sturgeon and clean air and clean water and stewardship and advocacy someday, we hope. And it's a very awesome program because the students just absolutely love their sturgeon and they're very protective over it. And it's an experience that when they bring that fish back to the river where it was born and they release it like free and willy, you know, it's an emotional experience that they never forget. And I just wanted to throw that out there just as a parting shot, because we are currently scheduling the students to come back, or the classes, depending on their COVID rules, to bring their fish back to the river here in the next month to release it and set it free after having it for, 7 months. And it's quite cool because they're galvanizing around the movement at a young age.
Well, the younger you get them, the better off we all are, I'm sure.
Exactly.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the effort to keep spawning lake sturgeon safe with Brenda Archambault, head of the organization Sturgeon for Tomorrow. We're also talking with Dave Borgeson, fisheries supervisor at the Michigan DNR. Dave, does DNR award any sturgeon fishing licenses? Maybe at other times of the year?
Well, the Black Lake season, it's really confined to like the first Saturday in February, and it's a limited harvest opportunity for the quota is based on the size of the population of spawning adults. So we do an estimate every spring, and then we get a number of like it's around, 1,200 fish, let's say. So like 1.2% of that can maybe harvested. So it gets down to, I think, 14 fish last year. And that allocation is split evenly between the state of Michigan anglers and the tribe. So we were allocated 7 fish in February, and that's how many we harvested in the season.
Can you give us a sense, maybe, Dave, of how sturgeon's numbers, how different they are now compared with, say, 50 years ago or 100 years ago?
Well, I would say 100 years ago, or even maybe longer, before there was a commercial fishery in the Great Lakes, I mean, they were everywhere. And before dams in our rivers, they had access to a lot of spawning habitat. So they were very prominent species. And because after dams that kind of truncated the amount of habitat availability, and they were harvested just en masse by a commercial fishery, their population has dwindled. But in the past 20 years or so, we're seeing things turn around a bit. Lake St. Clair is, and the St. Clair River is producing fish. We're seeing some fish produced naturally out of like the Muskegon River, the Manistee, St. Mary's, and the Black Lake population has turned around due to some stocking efforts and protection efforts. So I think we're seeing, due to a lot of targeted rehabilitation efforts, things turning around in Michigan, and that's really great to see.
For sure. Brenda, your organization is called Sturgeon for Tomorrow. Kind of sounds like a campaign to get some of these fish into office.
Well, you know, they are quite stately. They're the elder statesmen of Michigan's fish species, and they're native. And that's important, too, because having a native species is so much more grandiose than having these invasives. But it's really important for our organization to educate, engage, and then mobilize conservation stewards around lake sturgeon rehabilitation and recovery. Many people don't even know about them. Some people have heard of them, and especially those who spend time on the river or invest time on the river. It's really nature therapy at its finest. But that stewardship ethic is really important for our organization, especially to pass on to our next generation. We actually invest a lot of time and effort into that because, you know, these fish can live to be over 100 years old. Who's going to be here to defend them when we're gone? And, you know, to go back to the poaching issue, you know, we have been working with representatives in Lansing to increase fines for poaching sturgeon. And so we want to be able to, you know, have that be a deterrent. And so we're trying different angles and working at different angles for the greater good of the sturgeon. And as David mentioned, you know, actually for the last 15 to 18 years, there's been stocking of sturgeon throughout the Great Lakes Basin. And going forward, we're going to have more and more interactions with this majestic animal. And because of their vulnerabilities, we need to raise the bar. And say, you know, look, we have a lot of effort and decades into this recovery effort, and we need the citizens of the state of Michigan to step up and also be protectors. And if they see something wrong, that they need to report it.
How were you drawn to sturgeon and protecting them?
Well, when I was about 6 years old, I was ice fishing with my grandfather on Burt Lake. And so way back then in the 60s, I saw a sturgeon on the ice. They were harvested. I never forgot about it. It was just like, wow. But I remember looking into the eye of the sturgeon, and it was like diamond shaped, like pictures of dinosaurs that I had seen. That was my first encounter. But I grew up on neighboring Mullet Lake. I live now on Black Lake. And when we back in the mid 1990s heard that the state was going to develop a lake sturgeon rehabilitation plan, we wanted to engage in that process. And that's kind of how the saga began back in 1999, when we incorporated as a nonprofit organization, which is our mission is to primarily assist fisheries managers in the rehabilitation of lake sturgeon. And so for me personally, 25 years later, we've seen a lot of progress. We've seen a lot of engagement and mobilization. So when people are on the river, they not only engage with the fish, they engage with the river. And that means a lot in terms of the sustainability of the resource.
You know, we don't interact with fish in wild spaces quite the same way we do with mammals or birds in a forest. And I imagine that for folks who care about sturgeon, that it's not always easy to drum up supports for its protection in the way that we can talk and advocate for charismatic animals like wolves that look like the dogs that we have in our homes. Do either of you have a have things that you say to new people who maybe have never seen a sturgeon and can't quite understand the importance of a very large fish in the larger ecosystem?
In my opinion, part of the value of them is they are an indicator species. If sturgeon are doing well because they need, you know, clean water, they need, you know, clean gravel, they need connectivity because they utilize the lakes and the streams. So if sturgeon are doing well, that's a good indicator of the health of the system. And when I see people and talk to them about, well, I'm not so sure about sturgeon. What, you know, what's their value? And some of them say, well, that's kind of an ugly fish. Come to the river and see them, and they will never say that again. They will say, oh my gosh, what a beautiful, beautiful fish that is. So it's a great iconic fish, but it's also kind of just indicator species for the health of the environment.
Dave Borgeson is with the Fisheries Unit of Michigan Department of Natural Resources. And Brenda Archambault is head of the organization Sturgeon for Tomorrow. If you'd like to learn more about how to volunteer to help the lake sturgeon, just head for sturgeonfortomorrow.org. Brenda, Dave, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
Up next, a Detroit City Council member who made history talks about passing the torch. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. 2021 is an election year in Michigan's largest city, and Detroit City Council will soon look much different. Four members have announced that they're not seeking re-election. One of the members who made that decision is Raquel Castañeda Lopez. She was the first ever Latina elected to Detroit City Council, and she represents a very diverse area of Southwest Detroit, and she joins us now. Raquel, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, over your time in public office, two terms, you've talked a lot about your family story and how it informed you going into public service. I have to ask, what did your mom say when you told her that you were not going to run for re-election this year?
My mom, I joke and say, you know, she's kind of like gangster, old school there. So she first she scolded me that she had to find out through the news because I wasn't brave enough to call and tell her. She's like, why did I have to find out through the news? And I was like, and then second, she was like, you know, to her credit, and I know she's all coming from a place of love, is, you know, I don't really think you realize your impact, Raquel, and where's the commitment and integrity and stepping down now during these difficult times. And so, and sent me a whole bunch of other messages, which I just like skimmed over. And I just have been sending her all the positive comments from Facebook and Instagram. I'm like, look, mom, you can be proud. I think it's going to take her a little bit of time to digest. And I think like any parent, especially for women and women of color specifically, they know the danger in going into public office. Whereas I'm grateful that I physically have never been harmed, but there's a lot of threats that get made. I mean, I think much more we see at the federal level, but I mean, during my last re-election campaign, people literally came to my house. And so you never imagine yourself in those situations and not being able to protect your family. So I know it's always been hard for her to see me in that public role and be subject to so many types of attacks. So I'm sure there's some sense of relief and happiness, and she'll be proud, you know, sometime next year when it's all when it's all done and she can fully digest it. But it's a process. It's still a process.
Will you tell us about making the decision not to run again?
Yeah, I mean, I think honestly speaking, it was probably back in December of 2019. I was listening to one of the Brene Brown. She's a fellow social worker. One of her audio books on daring to lead and just the different roles that we can play in different spaces. And I think that's when I started thinking about, well, what is the role that I want to play, continue to play? And do I need to be in this role to impact and see the type of change I'd like to see? And I think when the pandemic hit, and then really more so the civil uprising as a result of George Floyd's murder, just kind of highlighted to me how much I really love and value, I think, just human connection, the ability to, like, you know, form coalitions, the power of listening and empathy. And not to say that you can't do these things in the role of a council member, but there is some skepticism about being an elected official because there's a lot of harm and a lot of, you know, historical oppression by governments towards immigrant communities and communities of colors. And so a lot of activists will approach me, despite my background in social work or organizing, you know, with some skepticism and, you know, not 100% sure about what my intentions and such are. And so I respect that and appreciate where they're coming from. And I think part of me is wanting to go back to that type of work without having to, you know, filter what I say all the time, believe it or not, or not having to be pulled away by showing up at council table, which is important in of itself. I think for me, it's really about wanting to be truly embedded 100% in community, and working alongside folks. And this position has definitely given me the privilege and the leverage to be able to do that in different ways. But, you know, in democracy, it's a team sport, right? And so we all play different roles. And where I've been grateful the past 8 years, my role has been as an elected official. I think it's important that we have always new voices, new ideas at the table and create spaces for new leaders, new people from marginalized communities to step into those leadership roles. And I will continue to play some other role on the team. And so that was kind of my thought process and where the decision came. Definitely very, very difficult. And even today, you know, I was excited and some sense of relief. It was public. And today I was like, oh, what did I do? So, you know, always going back and forth about the decision. But I am happy. I'm excited about, you know, I don't know what my next step is. And I'm just trying to be open and curious about it. But I know I can only control my own transition. And I'm super excited for Gabriela Santiago Romero, who I've, you know, recruited and endorsed. And for the next phase, because, you know, there's four of us that are stepping down. And so I'm excited. I hope that I've pushed the envelope and set the tone for what we can deserve as Detroiters. And I hope people step up to that plate in this next cycle of council.
The more I think about it, Detroit has been through such a ride that coincides with the time that you stepped into office. You know, when you first ran, the city was in the midst of this, you know, still lots of needs, but a gradual upswing in terms of the face of downtown, you know, investment from, you know, some folks outside the city and some folks in. And then this brick wall that we all hit in 2020, how would you say what people look to you for has been changing over this time, including but not limited to the pandemic?
For sure. I mean, I think when I first was elected, my, you know, my naive, sweet naivete in my early 30s, when I jumped in, I think really was almost like stepping onto a ship entering a storm or continuing into, you know, a storm. And so, yes, it's been kind of putting out fires all over the place and trying to provide some stability and constants for residents. And I think the pandemic, two things, of course, highlighted the incredible social inequities and inequities within our budget and how we allocate resources, and highlighted what I love and am so proud of in terms of being a native Detroiter is the resiliency and the spirit and the strength of our legacy Detroiters and just the power of human connection. And so, you know, prior to the pandemic, we worked with community leaders throughout the district. And I did want to clarify, I represent District 6, which is Southwest is just one portion. I always have to correct folks.
Right. Thank you.
It's downtown, midtown, Corktown, it's Midwest, it's Chazy Condon, it's Boynton Schaefer, Delray, et cetera, et cetera. Because if I let that pass, I will get scolded. And also too, I want those neighborhoods to be recognized and be honored. But I think we had built relationships with folks and those were just further strengthened. You know, we got to know folks more on a human level than I think even before. And so I would go out talking to folks porch to porch. And then with the pandemic, I think it just really brought out all of our humanity even more. And people would check in on my staff and I and being like, hey, how are you all doing? And we would maybe would share personal stories that we hadn't before. And it was really beautiful and really powerful. And I think just showed me the power of the spirit of Detroiters. And our level of connection only deepened and strengthened. So I think that also played into like, wow, I really love this aspect of the role and this aspect of the work and want to be able to commit more time to it. But it was about connecting people to basic services and resources, which I think is so key and so fundamental. Oftentimes in politics, people get caught up in like, you know, the sexiness of like creating jobs what's sensational in the news of some type of economic development deal or things that are policy ideas they want to move forward that, again, have importance. But we lose sight of, you know, addressing people at the basic level and meeting their basic needs and helping them live with dignity in that way, which I think comes first and is super, super important. So I think it kind of regrounded, rerooted me in the importance of that type of work during the pandemic, and just showed me the power of community and human connection. I mean, it was exhausting. Like, literally, I don't know, I would not even eat some days because I was on Zoom and I lost like 15 pounds because I was just like going. And it was residents who gave me the strength to kind of just push through and reminded me to take care of myself. And it was just really beautiful and really humbling.
A couple of years ago, you raised some concerns about how you were treated in the context of council. There has been some friction with some other members, Scott Benson and Andre Spivey. And at the time, you said you were feeling currents of racial animosity, currents of sexual harassment. And that led to a 2019 investigation of the dynamics on council, which did not draw the same conclusions. In hindsight, what do you want people to know about how council works today?
Yeah, you know, as I stated before, like, I've always been either the first or the only Latina in the majority of the settings my entire life. So I'm no stranger to discrimination or to racism or to sexism or to ageism or to heightism, you know, all the isms that play out in the different facets of my identity. And so I've disagreed with the results of the study. Also, the report wasn't based on my concerns. It was based on Council President Jones' interpretation of the concerns, which I think is important. And so I didn't request the report from CREO. It was something that Council President Jones requested. And so in all honesty, it's existed since day one. And I think where it's been portrayed as me and my individual issues, it really is pervasive in that my first year on council, there were at least three or four offices who young women from other staff would come to share because they felt comfortable with my team, where they felt that they were being sexually discriminated against or being harassed. Or it was just an environment where, you know, they would come in and be looked up and down and say, oh, people would say, I just came in to get my fill for the day with, you know, they're looking at these young women. Or I even witnessed my own staff leaving the building and experiencing the same types of things. And so I think it's ignorance. I think it's an old school mentality that is pervasive in politics, right? That as women, again, especially young women of color, you're there to kind of please other people. You're supposed to be quiet and not question. And I think for me in my decision and actually being open and honest about it is that in this role as a leader, it was kind of like, who do you go to? Where do you go? How do you address these things? And so it's my job. It's my job as a woman of color to make sure that I am not remaining silent myself and that I'm speaking up for other women of color who have experienced this around the country and to make sure we're changing the system. So I will actually be presenting in the next couple of months an amendment to the rules to require that all council members and their staff go through mandatory training on an annual basis around sexual harassment, around implicit bias, around working with our most vulnerable communities in the disability community and the LGBTQ community and the immigrant community, because it's about developing that awareness and that empathy to be able to best serve residents in the city of Detroit.
Was the way you were treated part of your decision when you decided to leave?
No, absolutely not. There's always different things that you wish you could change and you wish would have been better, right? But absolutely not. For me, it was, again, about, you know, what is the work that truly brings me joy? What are the settings that I want to be in? For me, it's really about exploring the next step in my journey and in life and creating opportunities for new folks like Gabriela to step into the role. And really how I approach and believe our democracy should work is that to truly have a reflective, inclusive democracy, you should have some change in leadership and make sure that leadership is definitely rooted in the values of racial justice and social equity. But I've been in council. Of course, I could have served another, you know, 4, 10, 16 years. But I think it's important to create those opportunities. And also, it allows me to play a role in some other regards. So that's really where the decision was coming from.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Raquel Castañeda Lopez. She is a member of Detroit City Council, but has said that she is not going to run for re-election this year. Raquel, you've been a strong ally to the Black Lives Matter movement and Detroit Will Breathe and other groups. Do you worry about leaving at a time when momentum is still building for change?
Well, see, this is a question my mom is asking me now. So I think this is also another piece that played into my decision. It's what role do I want to be in terms of being a part of this larger movement to impact systemic change? And where can I best serve? And so that definitely weighed into my decision. But I, again, am confident in Gabriela Santiago Romero and other folks like, you know, Pro Tem Mary Sheffield, who will continue to serve in leading that charge in the council aspect, so that I can step into a space and continue to really focus on building those coalitions around the types of policy changes they would like to see in the community space and through building, I think, community power, which I think is something that's still desperately needed in the city of Detroit, and to supporting other candidates citywide in other district seats and at the clerk and the mayoral race who will fight and champion for those same things. So as I said in my statement, it was never just about me or one politician. It's about the collective we and our shared movement for social justice and racial equity. And you need people in all seats across the city to be able to truly move those policies forward, not just in District 6.
Well, that kind of leads me to the last thing I wanted to ask you. You've said that it's still kind of an open page. You don't have anything lined up just yet, but you do say that you're going into advocacy. What was it about being in elected office that you'll take with you going forward?
I think so much learning, so many lessons. I think I learned, you know, being on the inside, quote unquote, about the power of listening, again, I think is really important from both sides, is really knowing and understanding the elected officials that represent you and vice versa, the elected officials understanding the wants and the needs of the community. And so I really think I've been effective in my role, if I can say this, in building bridges and building coalitions and bringing together people in the same space. And that I think is one of the most important first steps in leadership. And I hope to leverage the knowledge that I've gained of, you know, how to navigate the system to get legislation passed, drafting legislation to move forward resolutions and, you know, different community driven initiatives to bring that to the advocacy world and to try to build bridges between the two, because it's not just about getting folks who are progressive elected. You also need the grassroots movement. You need the progressive policies, and you need those three all working collectively to really impact change. And I think in the city, we have some really great policy ideas. We have some really amazing organizations, and that we're missing the connection with elected officials. And so I'd love to try to figure out how to build that bridge better. And then also, I think the other piece is just really, I'm not sure what my role will be for sure. I know I definitely want to just like sleep a little bit first before deciding next steps. But I think the other piece is holding elected officials accountable in a way that that's continual and not just around campaign cycles. It's really about switching how we approach campaigns and elections from this transactional type of way of, you know, vote for me and I'll give you this kind of quid pro quo, to really transformational, about investing in leaders, developing power within neighborhoods, and supporting that leadership on a continual, consistent basis that doesn't just happen every 4 years. And I think there's a lot of just education building that can go around that. So residents know what they truly deserve. I mean, I'm so grateful and so humbled by all the, you know, support that I've received, especially in, you know, broken hearts of me not running, but also people saying, you know, you set the tone and expectations on what folks deserve. And I do think it's true. They deserve everything. They deserve elected officials who will listen, who will see them, value them, hear them, who are committed to sitting on their French porches for an hour to listen to their stories without some type of, you know, objective in mind to get them to vote yes on this issue or that issue, but simply to honor what their needs are and to fight for those at a very basic level.
Raquel Castañeda Lopez of Detroit City Council. Raquel, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Nguyen, Nell Ovid, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. Happy Monday. We'll see you tomorrow.